Welcome to the Tech and Main Presents podcast with your host, Sean St. Hill. Sean is the CEO of Tech and Main, a technology consulting firm in Atlanta, Georgia. Listen in as thought leaders share their tips and insights about what's going on in the world of technology. And now, here's your host, Sean St. Hill.
Thank you for joining another episode of Tech and Main Presents, where we bring you the best insights from today's leaders and experts in technology. Today, we will be speaking with Mikko Huppanen. Mikko is the Chief Research Officer at WithSecure and the author of If It's Smart, It's Vulnerable. I'll let Mikko tell you about his background and amazing accomplishments. But first, Mikko, welcome to the Tech and Main Presents podcast.
Well, thank you, Sean. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you are welcome, sir. Thank you for joining us all the way from Helsinki, Finland.
That's right.
That is awesome. And Mikko, as I was telling you before we started the podcast, it really has been an honor to be able to connect with new friends like yourself from around the world.
Yeah, it's great to be here. And really, internet is making the world smaller. This right here proves it.
Absolutely, my friend. Absolutely. So Mikko, with that, go ahead and share your background with our audience.
Sure. So I'm a geek, I'm a nerd, I'm a programmer, I'm a reverse engineer, I'm a hacker hunter, hunting the bad hackers, the criminal hackers. This is what I've been doing all my life. I started programming on a Commodore 64 in the 1980s. I sold my first commercial programs when I was 17 in 1987. Then I started doing malware analyses, analyzing early viruses spreading on floppy disks in the early 1990s. And that's basically what I've been doing ever since. I've been tracking online attacks, online malware, viruses, worms, trojans, trying to figure out where these attacks come from, working together with authorities and law enforcement to track down online criminals. I've been part of many takedowns where organized crime gangs have been taken down. And I've been working throughout all these years here in Finland. Finland is home for me. I've been living in Helsinki all my life, although I've traveled a lot during these years for these different kind of projects I've been working on. Today, I'm the Chief Research Officer for WithSecure, which is the largest cybersecurity company in Northern Europe. And we do a lot of work in this area. My daily job is to do research for briefings that I can then give to our clients, to their leadership teams, to their boards. I do a lot of keynote talks in different conferences and so. And most importantly, after 30 decades in this business, I still haven't had a boring day at work.
That is awesome. So, Mikko, I do want to ask, because you brought up something that I think is really critical as it relates to your background, because we don't often have a chance to talk with someone as noted as yourself when it comes to taking down the actual bad actors, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, can you give us an idea of what that actually feels like? What are some of the emotions that come up as you are helping law enforcement and other organizations actually take these people offline, so to speak?
I've been a civilian advisor to Europol for a number of years. I've been an advisor to Interpol. I've worked with law enforcement in multiple countries here in Europe and in USA, typically with the Secret Service or with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And I suppose, in a nutshell, the word I would use to describe how it feels like is adrenaline. Because it's really like buzzing in your blood when you're working on a case and you're getting close. So typically these kinds of things would start to unravel when we are investigating a botnet or some piece of malware, maybe ransomware incident, and we have some technical knowledge or information, for example, a command and control server, which we know the attackers are using to communicate back to the infected machines, and we look at the logs, and then the actor, the criminal, makes a mistake. Typically, they forget to turn on a VPN, or they're not rerouting through Tor hidden service. They're exposing their real-world IP address, something like that. And we know it's golden. We know this is this is really valuable to actually catch these criminals. But of course, we can't catch anyone. We are a company. We can't go around arresting people. That's what we need, the cooperation from law enforcement. So we create a package, evidence, logs, information, backgrounders, and we send it to our friends with the law enforcement. And that's pretty much where it ends at our end. Law enforcement cooperation is, in most cases, very one-sided. We civilians provide information to them. They're happy to get it, but they can't really tell us much until they actually act upon it. They might send us thanks or greetings once they've arrested someone. I've never actually been on location when criminals have been arrested. I have met the criminals that I've been part of catching after they've been arrested, and I've been in courts facing them or faced them elsewhere after these cases. But it's not like we go around with guns arresting criminals. It's not like that. We find the evidence, we provide it to the law enforcement agencies, then we hope for the best. And it is exciting, but it's not like it is in the movies.
Oh, and Miko, that's one of the reasons why I asked that question. I think the entertainment industry has done both a service and a disservice to InfoSec and to the work that's being done like every day. Because it is dramatized, and you do think in that CSI episode, you're in the truck in the parking lot going up against the hacker. Right. And so we do have these, I think, grand thoughts and notions of what it's really like. But to your point, the reality is it's rather one-sided.
TV and Hollywood typically get it wrong, unfortunately. That's why it's so refreshing when sometimes they get it right. So, for example, in Matrix 2, they actually use a real zero-day exploit through Nmap. I believe the zero-day was in SSH. Which was really refreshing because it actually looked real and it was brand new at the time when they made the movie. Funnily enough, I've actually been a couple of times a technical advisor for TV productions which involve hacking scenes, and I've tried to make sure that things are correct. So for those of the members of the audience who know how it's supposed to work, they would actually see that it's real. I mean, this is actually the way it would be done. Fun fact, I've actually been stunt hands for a female hacker in one TV series I was advising, because the actress who was playing the hacker, she couldn't actually touch type. So, and of course I can. So they had like close-ups where the hacker was writing code and she couldn't do it. So I would actually be dressed up with nail polish to look like her hands. And I would be doing the hacking part. So exciting stuff.
That is awesome.
Yeah, but it's great when you get to look at the other side and actually assist, making sure that sometimes Hollywood gets it right.
Well, it's good to know that there are folks like yourself, Miko, that are that are helping by putting on the nail polish.
I had to do some explaining to my friends about the nail polish later.
Oh man, that is so cool. That is so
Miko.
Cool.
What's with the nail polish? Well, I can tell you. Let me tell you.
Yes, let me explain.
Yes.
Wow. All right. So, Miko, we've touched on this a little bit, but tell us specifically, what has you most excited about your daily work?
That's really simple. That's the feeling I get, that the work we do matters, and it matters to normal people. Like, I work for a cybersecurity company. When our phones ring, it's always someone who needs our help. Like, help me, help us. Our company has been hacked. Can you help us? We're under a denial of service attack. Our online store is down. This is costing us $100,000 an hour. Can you help us? We've been hit with ransomware incident. We don't know what to do. Do you know what we should do? And it feels good when we know what to do, because we've done this 100 times before. We have the experience. We know how to advise these people. We have the tools, we have the expertise, and it feels good when you can use your expertise to help other people. And I'm not saying that we're doing this from the goodness of our hearts only. This is a business. We're trying to make a profit. Yes. But it's a little bit more than just a business. It really is, in many ways, something that feels good at the end of the day when you leave the office. You feel like you're on the side of the good guys against the black hats, and that just feels good, and that's what keeps bringing me back, and that's why I've been doing it for 30 years.
All right, so Miko, you bring up another point that I'd like to highlight. And so these customers that are reaching out to you saying, hey, we're under a DDoS attack. We are under something that I heard of recently, a TDoS, you know, the voice over IP version, mm-hmm. telephone denial of service. What advice would you give them if you could catch them maybe a month before they actually have to call you? What are some things that you would advise them to do to help not get to the point where they're calling you frantic? Oh my God, we're under attack.
The advice I would give them might sound a bit weird, but what I would tell them is that I would advise them to assume that they will fail. Assume that whatever you're building to defend your organization will fail. Assume that all the work, all the investment, all the budget for years you've been doing to try to defend your organization will not be able to do what you thought they would be able to do. Assume that you will be hit. Assume that someone will breach your network. Assume that someone will find a way through all the defenses you've built, because it's all too easy for us to assume that the work we've done won't go into vain. We don't like to think that it's all been, that it's going to fail. We've spent so much time and money to build these defenses. We don't want to think they will fail. And that's exactly what we should be thinking. We should assume that there's going to be breach anyway. And I'm not saying it's a bad idea to try to keep attackers out from your network. Of course, it's a good idea to build defenses. It lowers the amount of breaches you will have. But you shouldn't assume that you will be successful in keeping every attacker out all the time. In fact, you should assume it's going to happen, because that changes the mindset from trying to keep everyone out into trying to detect when the breach happens. And that means you're looking for the breach, and that means you will find the breach faster, which means you can react to the breach faster.
I love what you just said, Miko. And here's why. I deal quite a bit with higher education and primary schools here in the States, in the state of Georgia specifically. And when you look at the budget that they have, Miko, most K-12 schools, the school districts, spend $20,000 a year, U.S., on cybersecurity and InfoSec. That is a pittance.
Mm-hmm.
That is such a minuscule amount. And so not only should you, as you so eloquently said, assume that you will fail, when you have that small of a budget, you really have to be of the mindset that, okay, what we're throwing at InfoSec and what we're throwing at securing our networks, it really is not going to keep, or it's not scaring anybody, really.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's very true. So it really is about visibility, knowing what happens in your environment. Like, what systems do we have? How many workstations do we have in the network right now? How many mobile phones? How many tablets? Where's our data? Which cloud systems are we using? How is the data flowing? What does a normal day look like in our networks? And then once you know what normal looks like, then you can start looking for abnormal things. And some of those abnormal cases are just abnormal cases, but some of those will be attacks or breaches. And that's how you find them, without being able to detect a specific thing, just detecting that this is weird. And that's really powerful.
Okay. Miko, so I have another question for you. Here in the States, we have, you know, and really around the world, you have managed security service providers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the third party provider that comes in and takes over the responsibility for checking your logs, making sure that, you know, your software is patched. What are your thoughts on that role of a managed security service provider?
I think it's a good idea for the kind of organizations which can't handle it by themselves, which is most of the small and medium companies. And that's why the MSSP market is thriving. There's a lot of companies which realize that they are not experts in this area. They cannot hire experts on their own in this area because there's such a lack of skill in the area and the experts are so expensive. So they outsource it. And this, I mean, it might feel kind of bad. I mean, outsourcing the very core of your operation, because, you know, data and our computer systems are the heart of many organizations today. Data is the new money, like we say. So you would outsource the security of your data to an outside source. But then again, if you think it through, most organizations don't have their own armed guards guarding the headquarters in the middle of the night, do they? They outsource that to a guarding company. This is no different. You're not an expert in guarding the physical building, so you outsource it. You're not an expert in guarding the cybersecurity, so you outsource it. But of course, it's important to choose the right partners and choose the partners that are right for you.
Okay. And how would one go about choosing the right partner?
That gets much more complicated, and I'm afraid it might be outside the scope of our discussion here. I don't know if there's a good advice I could give which would be fit in a nutshell, but when you find the right one, you find the one which will be able to provide you the services that you need at a price point which makes sense to you. And you do have to consider that MSSPs, they are also a liability. We've seen cases where companies get hacked because the MSSP gets hacked. So choosing an MSSP for many organizations is the right choice to make, but you really have to make the right choice.
No, that's a good point. You have to do your due diligence as you would with any other business decision. So
that's right.
I think that's a wonderful answer. All right. So, Miko, let's talk about your book, If It's Smart, It's Vulnerable. What made you decide to write that book?
I've been wanting to write a book on my own for a decade. Now, I've worked in multiple book projects before. I've written 5 or 6 books together with other people over the years, but I've never written one on my own, even though I've tried. But it's kind of hard. I did a TED talk in an official TED conference in 2011, so 11 years ago. And since then, I've been trying to write a book because I've been asked since that talk over and over again by people to write a book. So I started, and then I changed the topic, and then I changed the topic again. And I was trying to get something done, and at the same time, traveling the world every week. So it was really hard to get anywhere with it. But what really, really was the key? The pandemic was the key. When the pandemic hit, my travel stopped, and I had no more excuses. Then I really did need to write the book, and I did. I'm really glad I got it finished, and it's out there. It came out from Wiley in August, and it's now available globally, and it's doing pretty well. So I'm really happy about the project, and I was able to collect what I think is what I've learned over the last 30 years and put it behind one set of covers. So it's really, in many ways, the things I believe are shaping the world around us right now.
Okay. And so for those of our audience that haven't yet had a chance to read the book or dig into it, what are some of the highlights that you'd want to share?
Well, the title of the book is a reference to what many call the Hyppönen law. If it's smart, it's vulnerable. And that's a reference to smart devices. When we add functionality and connectivity into everyday devices, they become smart. But at the very same time, they become hackable because there's now code running on your watch. If you have an old mechanical watch, it's unhackable. If you have a smartwatch, it is hackable. That's a very pessimistic law, but it's also true. So that's one of the topics I speak about in the book. But it's not the only thing. In fact, I go through the whole revolution happening around us. We are living in the middle of a massive technological revolution, the biggest technology revolution that mankind has ever seen. In fact, we, our generation, will forever be remembered as the first generation in mankind's history who went online. The mankind walked this planet, walked on this planet for 100,000 years offline. We got online during our time, and now we will be online forever. That's how we will be remembered forever. And that is the best thing and the worst thing which has happened during our time. The upsides that this internet revolution is bringing to us are massive. All this connectivity, all these new types of business, all these new forms of entertainment. I love the internet. But at the very same time, it's totally changing crime from a local phenomenon to a global phenomenon. It's exposing us to completely new types of risks. It's exposing the fact that our minds can be altered by information operations, which can be used to win and lose elections, for example. Yes. And at the very same time, we're seeing how war is expanding from the real world to the online world in the form of things like cyber war, which we are seeing played out right now in Ukraine, as Russia is using offensive cyber power to wage war. So it's the best thing and the worst thing. So in many ways, it's a reflection of our real world. Our real world has all these great things and all these downsides as well. And the internet so exposes exactly the same phenomena in this new online world. And then I also speak about the future of the internet. Like, where are we going to go next? This is the first 30 years. What's going to happen in the next 30 years? And I am pretty optimistic. Surprisingly, maybe optimistic about the future, considering that I've seen the worst parts of the internet. I've worked with the worst parts of the internet throughout my career. I am an optimist about the future, and I do believe we are headed towards limitless computing, which basically means we will eventually all have access to unlimited computing power, unlimited storage, unlimited bandwidth for free or close to free. And that's a really powerful view of the future, but I do believe that's exactly where we're headed.
Okay. So, Miko, a couple things. So, Viasat, the company that provided satellite internet to the folks in Ukraine, mm-hmm. and Russia was able to take them offline. When we look at the different types of internet connectivity, right, and the fact that, as you said, I mean, we're connected in so many ways now, you know, what can a company like Viasat do, you know, to be able to kind of keep themselves stable, up and running, if you will?
The Viasat attack is highly unusual. It's not the first time we see Russians hacking satellite systems, but this is the most elaborate thing we've ever seen from them. Already 6 years ago, we saw the Turla attack, which is an operation from the Russian GRU, that's the military intelligence from the Russian government. Turla was a espionage case where they were using stolen satellite bandwidth to send the secrets they were exfiltrating from the target companies back to them, using satellites as a way to hide where the information was going. But we know it was the Russians, but it's just very, very hard to prove because they were using satellite, stolen satellite connectivity to get it out. Now, in the Viasat incident in February of 2022, the attack was highly technical. They were actually able to use an exploit against the vulnerability in the Viasat modems, satellite modems, to overwrite the firmware on these devices. This level of attack is actually very hard for defenders to defend against. I've sometimes said that, you know, if you're trying to defend yourself against the street mugger, that's doable. Just take safety precautions. But if James Bond wants to kill you, James Bond will kill you.
Oh, absolutely! Like, there's that's a done deal.
Yeah, there's nothing you could do. You could wear a bulletproof vest. You could wear a helmet. It makes no difference. He's going to kill you anyway. And that's the difference between like criminals and governmental actors. Governmental actors have the resources. They have the budgets. They have the know-how. If they want to get you, they will get you. So the best thing you can do is to detect that there's a breach. So again, it goes back to what we just discussed. Viasat probably couldn't have prevented this from happening, but they could have detected that there's a breach and maybe stop it from getting out of hand. This level of attackers have the know-how and the exploits and the budgets to find weak points. If they don't find a weak point, they'll keep trying until they do. If they still don't find a weak point, they'll have a mole recruited by the target organization to work from within them and then work inside the organization to create a vulnerability. That's the level of operations we're talking about here. And that's a really hard thing to fight against. Fighting against criminals is much easier. You don't have to have foolproof technology. You just have to be a little bit harder target than the other victims. Then the attackers will go after the other victims. But when you're a target of a governmental operation, they will not change their mind. They will keep trying until they get in. And your best hope is to detect immediately when they get in.
Okay. Well, Miko, let's take that picture that you just painted and let's bring in the reinforcements, right? Let's talk to the young people, those that are looking at a career in cybersecurity and in technology to be able to come alongside the Mikos of the world and help fight the good fight. What advice do you have for those young people?
Well, first of all, choosing technology is the right choice to make. Technology is the big change maker right now. The biggest way to make a dent in how the world works right now is with technology. It's the great amplifier. If you can use technology, you will be way ahead of those who can't. And getting into cybersecurity especially is a really good choice as well. Believe me, I've been doing this for 30 years. Not only is it highly interesting, but it keeps changing all the time. You never have a boring day, and you're fighting the good fight against bad people, which always feel good. Now, how do you make a great career in technology? My advice is to pick a niche. Find a niche that you enjoy. Find a niche where you believe you can make a difference, and then go all in that niche. And it doesn't matter how narrow the niche is. If you're one of the best in something, it doesn't really matter how narrow that something is. You will always find a great job. There's always going to be people who want to hire you for your skills if you're one of the best in that area. So it could be something really narrow, like, I don't know, configuring the Red Forest configurations for Microsoft 365 cloud environments in a specific way. That's pretty narrow. But if you're one of the best in your country, one of the best in the world, that's going to be a good gig for you. So find your niche. Find the thing that you want to go all in. Then go all in. That's my advice.
Miko, I love that advice. So before the podcast started, we were talking about a number of different things. And I was telling you the people that I've had an opportunity to interview. And one of them that I mentioned was Rafay Baloch. He's an ethical hacker and researcher out of Pakistan. And he is a wonderful example of what you just talked about. Right. He actually has gained such a level of notoriety that he's considered the top ethical hacker in the entire country. Right. And so his level of expertise is such that he's par excellence. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what you're talking about. If you niche down to the extent that you become known in your country or your region of the world, you know, that highlights so wonderfully the good advice that you just gave.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also important that you're able to share the information that you're good at something. So you have to be able to produce some visibility for your skills, which could be writing, keeping a blog, running a podcast, or doing talks. And this is different for different people. Some people are not comfortable on stage, but they love to write. Other people are the other way around. But make sure that people, potential clients, can find you. So it's not enough that you're the best in the world. The world has to know that you are the best in the world.
Oh, that is a great follow-up. So, Miko, we talked a little bit about your optimistic view of how the internet has changed the world. What else would you like to share about that topic?
Well, I haven't always been an optimist. I sort of decided to be an optimist because it's true that I've been spending way too much time looking at really dark corners of the internet and browsing through the forums where people's private details are for sale or credit card information are for sale or illegal stuff. Different kinds of illegal stuff is being traded by the scum of the internet. So it's all too easy to get, I don't know, depressed or something like that. But my attitude really changed a couple of years ago when I met this polar explorer, a Norwegian guy who's maybe in his late 70s or early 80s by now. And I had a long chat with the guy. And he told me about his life, how he has skied through the South Pole and North Pole multiple times, skis through Greenland once a year, like you do. All these amazing things. And he explained to me how he has seen the effects of global warming with his own eyes, how every year the snow is thinner and the ice is further away. It keeps escaping. So I asked him, okay, what does he think about global warming? And he surprised me by telling me that he's an optimist, which I wasn't really expecting. But I asked him, why, how can you be an optimist? And he told me that, Mikko, it's too late to be a pessimist. And that really stuck with me. And I decided to do the same thing with my attitude. The situation online isn't great. But we must not be pessimists. It's too late to be a pessimist. We have to be an optimist. And I am an optimist. I do think we're headed towards brighter times. And security of our systems, especially the technical security of the systems we use today, has never been better. And I know it doesn't look like it, because whenever cybersecurity makes the news, it's about the failures. But that's really how the news works. When there is a success story, when a company is able to fight the attackers, when they patch their systems in time, when their safeguards work, it only means that nothing happened. It only means that they did not get hacked. And I can guarantee to you, Sean, there won't be a headline in newspapers tomorrow in, let's say, USA Today, that the second largest company in USA was not hacked yesterday. That's not news. When companies don't get hacked, that's not news. When they get hacked, that is news. So we only see the failures. And rarely is anyone thanked for stopping a disaster which didn't happen.
No, that is true. There are no pats on the back for doing your job, as they say.
Yep. I've coined the term. I actually mentioned this in my book. I've coined the term cybersecurity Tetris as a reference to the rules of Tetris, the game. Because you're trying to build, you know what you're supposed to do in Tetris. You're trying to make a whole line. Actually, you're trying to make four whole lines at the same time. That's what they really call a Tetris. You get extra points for clearing four lines at one go. And what happens when you succeed and clear a line or clear four lines?
The game
it disappears.
Keeps going.
Yeah. And the lines disappear. That's what happens. Now, when you succeed, it disappears. And this is what happens in cybersecurity. Our successes disappear, but our failures pile up.
Now, that is a good point. Well, Miko, let's do this. Let's find out a little bit more about you personally. And the first question I would ask is, name your favorite musician or band.
Well, I don't know if you know this, Sean, but Finland is the heavy metal capital of the world. We have more heavy metal bands in Finland per capita than any other part of the world. So obviously my favorite band is going to be heavy metal. And I have a long hair, not by accident. It's pretty handy when you're listening to metal bands live on stage. But I'm not going to name a Finnish metal band. There would be plenty of Finnish metal bands I could name, but I'm going to be going with an international artist because my favorite band for the last couple of years is really unusual. It's a chiptune heavy metal band. So it combines heavy metal guitar and drums with computer-generated chiptune backgrounds, which sounds awesome. And the band I'm referring to is called MBR, Master Boot Record. And I'm sure you can slice a short segment of one of their songs right here in this audio when you're playing this back to the listener so they have an idea of what chiptune heavy metal sounds like. But yeah, that's my favorite band. I've seen them live. They're excellent. They have multiple records out, and Master Boot Record, my favorite band. Please check it out.
Master Boot Record. And Miko, it's funny. A friend of mine told me recently, he said, Sean, you've got almost 200 different artists that your guests have shared with you. He's like, you need to create a Spotify list.
Yes, you do.
Spotify playlist. And you know what? And Miko, MBR is that this is going to be the first band added to that playlist, because I think that is so cool. So Miko, thank you for helping spark or remind me of that idea. So coming soon will be a Spotify playlist.
Excellent.
All of the wonderful bands and artists that my guests have mentioned. Awesome. All right, Miko, how about a favorite hobby or pastime?
Well, I am a geek and a nerd, so I've always been interested in gaming, especially nowadays retro gaming, games of my youth. I was born in 1969, so I was a teenager during the video game boom of 1970s and 80s, which means Space Invaders, Pac-Man, all the classics. So I've been collecting and restoring the original coin-operated video games from that time. But slowly and surely, I'm migrating from video games to pinball. So my favorite pastime nowadays is really pinball. I've been collecting and restoring a lot of pinball machines. I also play competitively in pinball. If you don't know, that's a thing. People actually compete. There's a world championship in pinball playing.
Really?
Very, very competitive. Good players are remarkable in their skill, as you might expect. And nowadays, I mostly, when I buy new pinballs, I actually buy them straight from the factory because I'm getting a bit lazy. If you buy a secondhand pinball, there's a lot of repairing to work. But if you buy a brand new pinball and you only use it at your home, they last for years. You don't really have to do much anything at all. You just wax the play field every now and then, but nothing really breaks because they're really sturdy. They've been built for bar use, so home use is pretty easy on them. Most of the pinballs are made actually in Chicago. So I just every now and then order a brand new pinball straight from Chicago and have it shipped to Finland. And I have it a couple of years, then I sell it. Typically, they don't really deduct in value either. They're very, very popular things for people have in their homes nowadays. So most of the pinballs nowadays are not in bars, but in people's homes. I have several.
Interesting, interesting.
You should ask me, what's my favorite pinball?
What is your favorite pinball?
Well, the latest I bought is Godzilla from Stern, which I got straight from the factory, which is great, but I would have to go with Metallica, which is like 15 years old. I had it for many years. I made the mistake of selling it, and I miss it almost all the time.
So. Okay. Who'd you sell it to, Miko?
To another collector. I wish I could buy it back, but he's not selling.
Ah, okay. So it's interesting, and I'll have to go back in the archives to see who this other person is, but there's one other person that is also a pinball hobbyist. And so I'll have to connect the two of you when I find out.
Yeah, it's a great hobby, and it's a game of skill. When you play enough, you really learn how to stop the ball and how to really aim and how to keep the game going for hours. So it's a great, great thing. Really relaxing.
Oh, and you know what? And when you think about the amount of stress that comes with InfoSec, cybersecurity, technology, anything that can help lower that stress level is definitely a good thing.
Yeah, agreed.
All right. So, Miko, how about a favorite place to visit on vacation?
Well, I live in Finland. I live by the sea. Summers are really nice over here. I wouldn't go anywhere during the summer. Like, really great nature and, you know, everything you could ask for. However, winter time and fall time, they can be a bit rough. It gets pretty cold and the day gets really short. As we are recording this right now, the sun here in Helsinki goes down around 3:30 in the afternoon, which is a bit short. So I do like to break the dark winter and go typically to Spain. So Spain is nice and warm and the day is much longer. Spain or maybe northern Italy, which has really great places and great food. So that's where I go. Those are the places I like when I'm not enjoying the paradise of Helsinki, Finland.
Okay, that's good stuff. So, Mikko, what teacher at any level has had the greatest impact on you?
Well, that's not going to be a teacher from my schools or university. That's going to be a teacher from the internet. That's going to be the great Flavia. Flavia, unfortunately, late great Flavia, used to write these text files in the 1990s about reverse engineering and cracking. How to crack copy protection, how to reverse engineer code, how to build frameworks for understanding how to take code apart. Basically text files that I would download and read and reread over and over again and taught myself on how these things really work deep down at the assembly level. Many of the things that I needed for my work in reverse engineering malware, I really learned from these cracking guides, which really weren't about reverse engineering malware, but about cracking copy protections in games so you could illegally copy them and things like that. And the text files written by Flavia are maybe the most elaborate and maybe most important for me. So I'm going to name Flavia.
Okay. Francesco Vianello.
That's right. From Italy.
From Italy. Yes. And that is certainly a name that I am going to want to become more familiar with.
Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, he left us already maybe 15 years ago, but he really made a difference for me in the 1990s, in the most defining years for my career, I guess.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing Flavia with our audience. And Mikko, we're going to go back to the mid to late 80s, and we're going to talk to 18-year-old Mikko. What is the Mikko of today going to tell his 18-year-old self?
That's a great question. I think the best advice I could give would be that save your notes. Because I'd love to read my source code from 1988 or my notes or my the write-ups I wrote by myself. 1988 is way before the internet and way before the web, which means there's none of the stuff left that I did at the time, except a few occasional floppies I might have somewhere which I could still read. Most of my early stuff is gone, and I'd love to see it again, but there's no way for me to get any of that back. Nowadays, it's fairly easy to just archive your stuff and put it on a Dropbox or upload it to archive.org, and it should be there for decades. That's not the case for the information we had in the 1980s and 1990s. So yeah, my advice would be that Mikko, save your notes, archive them in a safe place. Future Mikko would like to take a look at them when he gets old.
Okay. That's, you know what, and it's wonderful advice, because what you're talking about is being able to look at your progression.
And it's maybe a personal request, but there's a thought there for a bigger picture as well. Archiving our current culture is important. We are the only generation which can archive our culture. And our culture today is online culture. So it's important that we save what's happening. What does the early web look like? The games we play, the entertainment we enjoy, the chats we have online. This is important to save because this is our culture, exactly in the same way like books were the culture or movies were the culture of 1960s, let's say. So we're the only people who can save this culture, and we have to do it right now. It's important for future historians. And that's why I volunteer part of my time working with the Internet Archive to save, for example, samples of early malware, which probably should be interesting for future researchers to take a look at. Somebody has to save them. I guess that's also one of the reasons why I started collecting old games. Somebody has to save them.
Oh, Miko, that is such... I mentioned earlier just wanting to be a good global citizen, right? And I think what you shared is a profound example of that, right? Someone has to catalog and archive the things that we're experiencing now so that, you know, what's that old saying that if you don't learn from history, you're destined to repeat it,
right? That's right. So that's exactly the way it goes.
Yeah. Well, Miko, to say that this has been a pleasure is an understatement. I'm going on record as saying we will have you back again very soon. You are one of the more fascinating people that we've had on the podcast. And honestly, I feel like there's several more conversations that we can have. So we're just going to put a pause on this. And I'll just say until next time.
Until next time, Sean. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, Miko. And thank you, Tech and Main Presents family, as always, for listening. And be sure to tune in next time when we will have another technology expert share their wisdom. Goodbye for now.
You've been listening to another episode of Tech and Main Presents. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Don't forget to tell your friends, and thanks for being a part of the Tech and Main Presents community.